All right. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Wall Big Book Experience, the What Any Length Looks Like Big Book Experience. And we're going to start off by Clark coming up and saying his version of the lay aside prayer for us.
Dear Heavenly Father, please set aside everything we think we know about your will for us, this program, what we may hear in this session, and everything we think we know about you, so that we may have an open mind and new experience. Amen.
Amen. My name's Tarek. I'm an addict and alcoholic. I want to start off by reading something that the first time I heard it, I fell in love with it, and then I looked for it and found it. And it's a great illustration of the purpose of why all of us go through this process. In the beginning, we think we go through this process to solve our problem with alcohol and or drugs. But that's not really the truth. The truth is we all ultimately struggle with alcohol and drugs because we lack a sense of purpose. We can't really sit still. We need to be doing something, and the world and the people in it create so much disturbance inside of us that we demand an anesthetic to deal with it, and we ultimately develop the physical abnormal reaction, then the mental, and we develop a problem, quote unquote. So this is what the purpose of everything, the real work, is so we can place ourselves in a position to do what this poem describes. It's called "I Stand at the Door." I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men, with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die, on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find Him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints, go all the way in. Go way down in the cavernous cellars and way up into the spacious attics. And it is a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements, of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is inside. Sometimes I take a deeper look in, sometimes I venture a little farther, but my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. There's another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God in the zeal of His house devour them. For God is so very great and asks all of us, and these people feel cosmic claustrophobia and want to get out. They scream, "Let me out," and the people way inside only terrify them even more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they are spoiled. For the old life, they have seen too much. One taste of God and nothing but God will do any more. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out just where they came in, to tell them how much better it is inside. To people, the people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door, but would like to run away. So for them, too, I stand by the door. I admire the people who go way inside, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet found the door, or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear Him and know He is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them, and remember they are there too. Where? outside the door, thousands of them, millions of them, but more important for me, one of them, two of them, ten of them, whose hands I'm intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I'd rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. This weekend, our intent is to give you a view into the big book in such a manner that you can sit down and take someone through this process without reading the book line by line. It'll give you all the prompts that you need to look at as you go through the book. It'll give you all the paragraphs that you need to touch on and have some deep conversation about, and perhaps even give you a series of questions that you can ask an individual as you take them through this process. But all of it culminates into this. This is the purpose of doing the work. The work that you're doing in the 12 steps, if you're in the process right now, it's not the real work. The real work in AA and CA is taking others through the steps. And so when a man walks up to me at a meeting and says, "Will you sponsor me?" my answer is never yes. My answer is typically, "Let's go grab a cup of coffee first. Grab some lunch, perhaps, or sit with me after the meeting, because I want to describe to them in detail what the circle and triangle means." And Brandon's going to cover that here in a minute. I want to describe in detail what it's going to look like for them to work with me, and I'm the sponsor. They do not set the pace. The men I work with know that. I'm going to set the pace. I'm going to take them through the steps. I'm going to give them the deadlines. And if they work with me, they're going to have to stick to that. And so I give them a clear idea of what it's going to look like. I share my experience with drugs and alcohol. I listen to some of their experience, trying to pinpoint, are they a drug addict? Are they the alcoholic? Are they both? What is really their master? I am trying to dig a little bit in that first initial meeting, but what I really want to know is if they are alcoholic and or addict. And I don't need to do too much digging to find that out. And once I know that, I give them a narrative of the 12 steps. This is what the first step is about, and this is what we're going to do. This is what the second step's about, and this is what we're going to do. And then when we're done, typically that takes anywhere between 15 to 20 minutes, I'm going to say to them, "All right, it's Friday, it's 7:30. I want you to call me Sunday night at 7:30 and tell me if you're willing to go through with the program of action that I've just described to you." And see what happens. I know early on in recovery, you're just excited someone's asking you to sponsor you. But if you implement this process early on, it'll save you wasted time. I promise you, it'll save you wasted time. So I'm going to hand it over here to Brandon briefly. He's going to cover the circle and the triangle and how that's our magic formula.
Did you introduce yourself?
I did.
I didn't hear it.
You weren't paying attention.
I was off somewhere else. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brandon. And I identify as an alcoholic, and we'll get into more of that later on. But on the title page of our big book, which is the one that says Alcoholics Anonymous, there used to be a circle and a triangle. We've all seen it. We all know what it's a symbol for AA, or we believe it's a symbol for AA, CA, recovery. But many of us don't really know what it really means. I know that most of the people in this room do because, well, I know most of the people in this room. But it was removed from the big book in, I think it was 94, 95, because there was an attorney general for the state of New York that was trying to take down AA. He was after not-for-profits, and he thought that AA was not who we said we were, so he came after us, and the only thing he could find is that we weren't enforcing the trademark on the circle and the triangle that was in our big book. And so AA was faced with a decision to either sue one of its members. At the time there were seven or eight companies that were making the little chips and medallions that had the circle and the triangle on it. And AA, the trustee, sent a letter to the manufacturers of these and asked them to cease and desist from putting the circle and the triangle on their chips. And all but one of them agreed. And that one said, "I'm not taking it off." So AA was forced to either sue a member of AA that was printing these circle and triangles on his chips, or to remove it from our book and take away the trademark. So if you have a third edition, I don't know what printing it is, you'll have everything prior to that. You'll have a circle and a triangle in it. Everything since that time, fourth edition, doesn't have it in it. It's an ancient symbol. Means mind, body, and spirit. It means being in incomplete unity. When I've got all, when all mind, body, and spirit are all working together, I am in balance. I take my mind into recovery. Recovery is the first 11 steps. Steps 1 through 11. I take my body into the unity part of it, which is the fellowship. That's the meetings. That's the conversations before the meetings. That's the conversations on the phone. That's the accountability with your network. And then I take my spirit into service. And for me, in the way that, that I believe it, based on my own experience, there is only one kind of service when you're talking about this, and this is carrying the message to the sick or suffering alcoholic or addict. There is service to the fellowship, making coffee, setting up chairs, cleaning ashtrays, all very vitally important to the fellowship in terms of the meetings can't exist if a bunch of alcoholics and addicts don't have coffee. They just can't. And so that service is necessary, but that's that. It's my opinion that that's not the service that they're talking about in the circle and the triangle. It's like, to me, it's like a three-legged stool. If you're sitting on a three-legged stool and you're in balance, it's pretty hard for somebody to knock you off. But if you take away one of those legs, you can probably stay on that stool for a little while, but if somebody comes and gives you a pretty good nudge, you're going to go down. If there's only one leg of that stool, you can balance yourself in such a way that you can stay on that stool for a little while. But very little interaction with you can knock you off. And so recovery is the same way. If you're not sponsoring people, you're not engaged, you don't have a home group, you're not engaged in the fellowship, you're not being accountable with those in your network, and you're not consistently practicing the steps 1 through 11, then if you're gone through the steps and you're attending a lot of meetings but you're not sponsoring anybody, you're only working two sides. You're sponsoring a bunch of people, you've gone through the steps, but you're not attending any meetings, you're only working two sides. Most people only work one side of the triangle, and that's the fellowship side, the unity side. They attend a bunch of meetings, their life's chaotic, they relapse, and when you ask them what happened, I don't know. I just made a decision to go out. But if you really start asking the person that has relapsed, and you start at the 12th step and you work your way backwards. It's all, without fail, I sit down with a guy that's just relapsed. Sit down and talk to him. And he says, you know, I've worked the steps, they don't work. You've worked all the steps and they don't work. Yep, worked all the steps and they don't work. Okay, how many people were you sponsoring? Well, I wasn't sponsoring anybody. But I was making myself available. I was raising my hand at meetings and nobody was approaching me. Okay, so you weren't doing the 12th step. Okay, so what does your prayer and meditation look like? What does your morning routine, what does your evening review look like? Well, I pray. Pray in the mornings. Put my shoes underneath my bed and I have to get down on my knees to pick up my shoes. And I pray every morning because I have to pick up my shoes from underneath the bed. All right, so what's meditation look like? It's too hard for me. I can't do that. Okay, so you're not really doing the 11th step. 10th step, daily practice. Are you consistently watching, asking, discussing, making, turning? What? Okay, so you're not doing the 10th step. Have you made all your amends? Yes. Okay, you've gone and approached all the people that you... Well, I went to all the ones that I thought should, that I really harmed. Okay, so who did you make that decision with? Well, I talked to my sponsor and he said I shouldn't go to these people because I might irritate them. Okay, so you've made how many amends? You know, I make my family and my brother and my sister and mom and dad. Okay, so you kind of did 9. All right, so when you had a 7th step experience, what was that like for you? when you went to the sixth step and you had your list of defects, did you take that to seven? Usually you get a lot of silence around here. They've done a fifth step, maybe done a fourth step. They did a third step. They turned it over. They took it back. They turned it over. They took it back. They turned it over. They took it back. So what does your second step look like? What's your connection with God? Do you believe that you actually have to seek the God with the desperation of a drowning man? When it comes to drugs and alcohol, yes, but I'm going to handle my girlfriend, my money, my job. I'm going to do all that stuff. Okay. So then you get to the first step, and you realize that they really have no idea what you're talking about when it comes to this. But when you see a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous, that they seem like, even when stuff around them is chaotic, that they seem to have a sense of peace and ease, and you approach that person and you say, where are you at in the circle and the triangle? They're generally going to be in balance. So for me, this is always a great place to start with a sponsee when you're sitting down with them, to find out, what do they think this thing's really about? And the circle and the triangle is a wonderful way to approach it. Now, what we see a lot of the time is in meetings, we see a lot of people that they just attend meetings and they seem to stay sober. And it's very confusing, because many of us have gone to 180 meetings in 90 days or 270 meetings in 90 days, and we still went out and got messed up. So why is it that these people that are meeting makers make all these meetings, why is it that they can stay sober just off of one side of the triangle? If you've got your big books and you go to chapter 2 Wives and go to page 108, one of the first things I do with anybody that I ever sit down with in my first meeting as a sponsor is I usually back up to usually page 106 or 107, but to expedite this, we're going to look at page 108. And at the bottom of page 108, it says, the problem with which you struggle usually falls into one of four categories. Number one, you have a husband who may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant, or it may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money on liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic or an addict. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. Some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number of them will become true alcoholics. Now, this indicates a person with power. They will moderate or stop altogether. What does the first step say? That we were powerless over alcohol. We were powerless over cocaine. We were powerless over all drugs. Well, if I'm powerless, like the first step says, truly powerless, there's nothing I can do. I cannot stop or moderate. I have no power. The first step at the core says I have no power. That's nothing I can do. So we go on to number two. Your husband may be showing a lack of control, for he is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe he is beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried at times and is becoming aware that he cannot smoke crack like other people. He sometimes drinks in the morning and all through the day also, to hold his nervousness in check. He is remorseful after a serious run and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over a run, he begins to think once more how he can use moderately next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic or addict. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say amongst ourselves, he wants to stop. Now,
Guys, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous are full of type 1 and type 2s. Attending meetings is sufficient for them to overcome drugs and alcohol. But then we got these two other types. Type 3. This guy has gone much further than number 2. Though once like number 2, he became worse. His friends have slipped away or run away. His home is near wreck, if he has one, and he cannot hold a position. Maybe the doctor has been called in, and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. He admits he cannot drink like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that somehow that he will yet find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. His case presents additional questions, which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. Does this describe anybody in here? Anyone? All right, we got one. Whew, two. All right, two people. I like to go through this, and I love it when I'm talking to a guy, especially if he's in some sort of recovery program, and ask him, I'll go through these one by one. Has the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals begun? And they say no. And I'll ask him, well, where are you? What do you mean? Well, I'm in a recovery place. What's a sanitarium for? Well, it's for people that don't know how to live life or can't live life or they're a danger to themselves and others. Well, why are you in treatment again? Why are you in recovery place again? Because you're a danger to yourself or others? You don't know how to live life? They usually succumb at that point and realize that they actually are in a sanitarium. We just changed the words of it to a treatment center or a recovery residence or something like that because it sounds better than a loony bin. Type 4, you may have a husband whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when high. Sometimes he gets high on the way home from the hospital. Sometimes he gets high in the hospital. Perhaps he has had delirium tremens. Or doctors may shake their head and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands were just as far gone yet got well. So the problem with the meaty maker make it slogan and a lot of other slogans that we hear is that the people that are saying them don't mean anybody harm by saying them. For a lot of people, meeting makers do make it. But a type 3 and a type 4, if you get one of those meeting maker make it people as your sponsor, you're not going to understand how to communicate with them because you're going to call them with a problem and they're like, well, it just sounds like you should get to some more meetings. No, you don't understand. I'm going to kill this guy. Give it to God. Go to a meeting. If your ass falls off, pick it up. Take it to a meeting. And these people, they mean well by this. They're not trying to harm you. It's just that they're a type 1 or type 2, and they don't really have to work all three sides of the program because their life doesn't depend upon it like yours and mine does. Most people do not, for fun, come on a Friday night and hang out with Tarek and I and let us cite parts of the big book to you. Some of you are forced to, but that's just where you're at. But that we have to do this all the way. Or what happens, guys? I mean, a lot of you know what happens. You just saw it. Half measures availed us nothing. That's not true. Half measures availed us nodding out on the couch and not being able to get up and have somebody take us to the hospital. Half measures avail us a couple shots to wake us up so that we can get our breathing in order so that we can go to the hospital and have them bring us back to health. That's what half measures bring us. Quarter measures give you even less. And so many people, they come here and they can't just submit to the process because they don't really believe that their life depends on it. Maybe they don't care if their life depends on it. Maybe they don't want to be here. Maybe they've just resolved themselves to the fact that they're going to going on to the bitter end, blotting out their intolerable situation. Maybe that's where they've come to. So, you want to hit? Yeah.
Thanks, Brandon.
Well, and guys, we're not. I mean, please ask questions if we hit something and it doesn't make sense, or if we're. I mean, the purpose of this is for you to get something out of it. It's not for us to sit up here and dictate to you things that maybe you've heard, maybe you haven't heard. It's to be interactive. It's been our experience that most people don't raise their hands in the middle of it. I'll call on you in a second. A lot of people come up between sessions, and that's okay, because we'll usually bring those things back in. But, Allie?
So I never went to a sanitarium or a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thoroughly convinced I'm a real alcoholic.
Have any of these other things happened to you? For me, I didn't. I'm.
Like, I understand the benefit of using before.
Mm-hmm.
But what I understand is that having an allergy to alcohol and an obsession with a spiritual malady is pretty much a qualifier. Like, attendance at a sanitarium or a hospital might be indicative.
Yeah, you're right.
I never attended sanitariums or hospitals. Now, there were plenty of times where I probably had alcohol poisoning and should have attended them. I just had no knowledge that I actually had a problem. So when I go through this with a guy, I'm much more thorough. Each line I'll ask him, is that you? And if we can catch, like, for me, I've got a little bit of four. I've got most of three except for hospitals and sanitariums. But if I look at my overall body of work, it's clear that I'm probably in between a three and a four, probably a 3.5 solid in there.
Yeah.
The longer I stay here, the more I creep towards the type four, because I realize that things were much worse than I thought they were. So I read those quick, but I generally dive into them at a much deeper level. Then there's other pages back where they talk about the moderate, the heavy drinker, and then the real alcoholic, and I'll take them through those too. Is this you? Because it's very important for a person to see themselves in this book and realize they wrote this book in 1937 to 1939, and I'm all over it. So I didn't.
I just wanted to be clear, it was far more an internal.
Oh, absolutely.
And
we'll get into those a little bit later in the session, but it's usually when people show up, they've got that material thing going on.
Yeah, no, for sure.
The inside, I don't know that I'm broken.
Right.
I just see that shit's going bad around me.
Yeah.
And it takes me some time to actually come to the realization that the inside causes all this outside stuff? Huh? Where'd that come from? So, thanks for the question, though.
I'm going to tell you all a story. I'm going to try to keep this short. So, if you go to an AA or a CA meeting and there's 100 people in it, and you say, all right, let's play a little experiment. And this is the reason that I cover the types of drinkers in the bag. And you're right. Just because you end up in treatment doesn't mean you're an addict or alcoholic. Okay, because what happens to the people like Brandon who never went to treatment? He's about as real alcoholic as I've ever seen. So,
or the guy that just gets a DUI and has to satisfy the courts, he goes to a 30-day program. I mean, the people, he may not be anywhere close to alcoholic. He just had too many drinks one night.
So let's take those 100 people, put them back in the bar or the party scene, and you're going to find three groups within that group of 100 people. You're going to find one group is going to walk into the bar. They're going to drink just until they feel good or just until they feel right. And they're going to go home. You got another group that's going to go to the bar. They're going to belly up to the bar. And they're going to cry in their whiskey. And they're going to wallow in their beer. And they're going to tell you this is all there is of alcohol and booze. And then you have this other third that's going to go and burn the bar to the ground. And then they're going to looking for the party after the bar. And they're going to burn that to the ground. And then they end up down on North Avenue and Boulevard. And they burn that area to the ground. And they stay down there for a few days. You take those 100 people out of the room, out of the bar, and you put them back in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how they work the steps. You have the people that treat the meetings like a spiritual filling station. They go and suck everything they can out of the meeting. I got to get to my meeting today, right? They go to their meeting, and they feel good, they go home. You got this other group that goes to the meetings and they cry in the meetings and they wallow in their big book and they tell you this is all there is of God in these steps. And then you got the mad dogs. They go to the meetings, they're spearheads for God's ever advancing creation, and they carry a message of depth and weight. And their characters usually get assassinated on top of it. Right? So, you take them through the four types of drinkers. What I tell guys, if you're a type four, you got to do type four step work. Right? So if you're a mad dog for shooting dope or drinking whiskey or smoking crack, you got to be a mad dog for the recovery process. And if you're in this room in your early recovery, there isn't a little bit of a desire in this flame inside of you to help people through this process, I'm going to tell you right now, you're not done. You're fucked and you're going to relapse. I'll tell you that right now, and I mean it. Everybody, I believe, must have that little bit of a desire, like a mustard seed, to watch somebody's lights come on in their eyes, to help them through this process. If you don't have it, my experience and my observations tell me you're not done. Okay? That's just my harshness for the night.
Right now.
All right. So Brandon eloquently covered that circle and triangle. It's got three sides to it. We have a three-part problem. We don't have a two-part problem. You know, I've heard the argument is that 99% of the humans walking on this earth have the spiritual malady. But see, I think it still has to be part of the problem, because it's the internal condition that Brandon mentioned that puts me in a position that requires I have an anesthetic in order to be free of the internal condition. Does that make sense? In our big book on page 64, so I'll take guys to this page, and I want to smash the idea it's a two-part problem, because I want them to get ready to really go deep down inside to see what the real problem is, which is the internal condition and these bedevilments, because we're consciously separated from God. So, on the bottom of page 64, resentment. They're talking about resentment, but if you skip the first three lines, it says, "For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. And once the spiritual malady is overcome, we will straighten out mentally and physically." So the recovery process addresses the mind and the mental, the fellowship and being around people that are like-minded, and they have this idea that we want to be active in this recovery process and this fellowship, so we go to these meetings and we share our experience and we have fun. That addresses the unity in the body, right? And when you sit down and you spend some time one-on-one with another individual taking them through the steps, how can you get bored? That's exciting. You cannot get bored. So this will address the service piece of it. That's the three-part problem. If you stay active in all three areas, I promise you, I will guarantee you, you will live a clean life and a sober life, and you will die clean and sober if you stay active. Now the question is, what type of drinker or user are you? That's going to tell you what kind of step work you have to do. So people know me. I'm very passionate about this process. If you know me and you're close to me, you know it. I do this how just like I smoked crack. So you can imagine what I smoked crack like. All right. So we're gonna go through these the preface. So very quickly, I get to the preface. I really want to drive home one important concept here. That this book is a basic text. It's a textbook. It's a teaching tool. If you're working with an addict, take the word alcohol out. Put the word addict in. I am convinced, after 9 years of working with others, that unconsciously, if you're working with an addict who has very little drinking experience and you're reading a book about alcoholism and you're just using the word alcohol and you're not really turning it into the drugs that the person struggled with, unconsciously, there's a little voice deep down inside that's perhaps, I don't know this to be the truth, but it's the truth the way I see it, is that perhaps there's a little voice telling them, this is not me. These people are not like me. This process will not work for me. So the egoic mind begins to separate them. That unconscious thing that happens inside of us will begin to separate us, and we end up walking away from the process. Does that make sense? Yeah? All right, so I want to focus on that. I also focus on the idea that this book is not designed to give you a bunch of knowledge or information. this weekend is not really designed to give you a bunch of knowledge and information. It's more like we're showing you the recipe. It's an emotional, pretty much an emotional cookbook, really. If you do all of these things, you have a significant change inside. The book calls it psychic change, a personality change. It's designed to transmit an experience to you, not knowledge. So if you put everything together, you'll have an experience. And if you do it quickly, you'll have an experience where you wake up on the other side 90 days in, you're like, holy shit, I haven't had an obsession to use or drink because I was taken through the process. I was forced to actually engage the recovery process. Now, this is also assuming there's a level of rigorous honesty underneath all of this. All right, so we're going to go. That was the preface. When I take a guy through, I'm going to spend time on this paragraph in the foreword to the first edition. You know, here's where the big book describes what you and I recover from and what our purpose is. We recover from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I want to emphasize, we do not recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind, body, and spirit. The spiritual aspect of it is what needs constant attention. Because if we get unfit spiritually, the mental obsession comes back. We put alcohol and drugs in our body, and then we're off to the races again. You guys see that? That's how this process evolves. But today, tonight, I'm sitting here recovered. I'm living in a recovered state. My addiction, the symptoms of it, the loss of control and the inability to stay away from the first one, no matter how great the necessity or the wish to do so, have been arrested. I don't suffer from that anymore. I've recovered from that. And to show others, I know you're going to think Brandon and I are going to tell you a bunch of stuff this weekend, but we're really not. We're trying to bear our experience. We're trying to go into our experience and bring it out to you and show you what we do. And then if you want what we have, then you do what we do. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Excellence. You spot it in someone else. All you got to do is do what they do. That's it. That's what I did. I spotted excellence in my sponsor. And I do what he does. And he has shown me. Yes, sir.
After you qualify the person, 108, then you go to the preface. You take the person through the preface, right?
It depends on who I'm working with. If it's a new guy that's never been through the book, absolutely. If I get a guy that's been around for a while that comes to work the steps with me, it just depends. If he's a big book guy, I may sit down and read the book line by line. I may not. If it's somebody I feel like I'm going to lose because their obsession is so strong, I'm going to try to take them the way I'm doing it this weekend, where in the preface, that's the only paragraph I touch on. I just need him to know this is a textbook, and I need him to know the recovery program is contained in these pages. It's the way of life described in the book. It really depends on what that person is going through. Not everybody gets the preface read to them line by line.
And it's important. The reason why we'll get more into it, why the meditation life, my meditation practice is so important is that meditation allows me to get intuition with a guy that he needs to go through it this way. He needs to go through it this way. And so I don't know that I've ever really sponsored two guys the exact same way because no two people are exactly the same. So some we go line by line. Others we jump around. If they have a lot of knowledge of the book, I'm going to confuse them by sending them to all different places that they've never read before and piece them all together because then their mind gets out of it and their spirit starts coming involved. So it just really depends on who you're dealing with. Go on.
Let's go. Yes, sir?
Do you have a recommendation of starting with the four types of addicts or alcoholics or starting with the mental obsession and the spiritual malady or the mental obsession and the physical allergy?
So, you want to answer?
You go.
This guy here is the first one that ever showed me that. To start with the four types. I don't typically start with the four types. I think it's a great idea. I may reference it as I'm taking a guy through the steps. I might be in the first step and we might flip back to it. I don't do what Brandon does. I typically will go on that circle and triangle, explain to him what recovery is and how it relates to the mental, physical, and the spiritual. But it's important that you touch the latter part of your question. Now, the four types, he has a lot of good experience with it. I use it later on. So in the beginning, I can't. He'd have to answer your question because I don't have a lot of experience with doing that. Doing it that way.
Yeah, for me, the reason why I need to know who I'm dealing with, and they need to know what they're dealing with. If I go through the questions and the guy's a type two, I'd straight out just say, "Look, you're going to struggle through this. You are going to get around the third and fourth step, and you're going to lose some steam, and you're probably going to peter out, and you're going to go on your own way." And I'll still work with you, but I'm letting you know that that's probably going to happen. Sometimes I just kind of hope that he'll spite me and do a fourth step just to show me, right? Usually doesn't happen. Usually, if they're a type one or two or maybe a type three, they usually peter out. And I do that because I want them to know when they're in a meeting, if they're a type four and they're hearing a bunch of type two share, they're going to be like, why do these people share this? Because that's the way they do it, and that works for them. And I think that it's most of the CA meetings that you attend, they're pretty mad dog for recovery. It's been my experience that AA is a lot more watered down, and there's a lot more people that go to AA meetings for the fellowship. They came to the fellowship. They had a little bit of a problem. Their wife sent them. They met some people. They got some friends. I'm going to stick around. There's a lot of people. A lot of people that I really like. I love them. But I wouldn't have them sponsor any of my kids. It's what fellowship you're in kind of depends kind of how you deal with that. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a type 2 or 2.5, something like that, are you saying that I might not be capable of working it properly until I reach type 4?
Not always.
Or are you saying that if I'm a type 2.5, I shouldn't sponsor?
No, I'm saying if you're a type 2.5, that you may not see the value in doing this as a way of life. You may not be a mad dog for it. But like I said, I used to think I was a type 2.5. As I share my story with other people and they share theirs, I'm a lot worse than I thought I was. I'm more like a 3.5. And so it's there's so many variables that you have to bring into it. I guess on some level, if you spend too much time in that and you don't really go through it in detail, it could get confusing to somebody, and I'm realizing that as we're getting questions on it. So.
This is more for the purpose of identifying who I'm working with, but I'll tell you, I've seen something over the years. I've sponsored guys, taken them through the steps, and they go find other sponsors. And they perhaps don't do what, because I rework the first 9 steps every year. I've done it every year I've been clean and sober. I don't know if it will continue into the future. People have described me as being over the top, too much to handle. A little militant. But that's because, and I'm not, look, guys, there's a difference here. Not a day goes by I don't think about smoking crack cocaine. Not a day goes by that I don't think about smoking crack cocaine. I do not obsess about crack cocaine. What I'm telling you is I'm driving down the road and the thought of smoking crack cocaine comes into my thought life, and then I take that deep breath and it goes away because I'm safe and protected. I'm not willing to run the risk of what happens to me if I go 2-3 weeks and disconnect from this.
Yeah. Can you tell me what your relapse looks like? Can you identify what set of circumstances are going to happen and you're going to relapse? Anybody?
Anger.
Well, but I mean, what's the experience before that? My point in asking the question is because I don't know what it looks like right before I walk out the door, I don't know which one of these things I don't need to do. If you can tell me that I know that this is the exact set of things that's going to happen before I relapse, then you can tell me that you don't need to meditate every day. You can tell me that sponsorship's not important. If you can't tell me that, then how can you tell me with all honesty, with all knowledge, that I don't I have to do any of this stuff? Because we don't know what it looks like when we walk out the door. One day we just get up and walk out the door.
And the wonderful thing about going through the types is you have an experience. It's not mechanical. It's not dogmatic. It's something new. And you're looking at it and you're like, well, I'm a 2.5. And then you start just considering things. I mean, I had a guy that I took through the steps that was somewhere between a 1 and a 2, right? And his higher power was he didn't want to get kicked out of med school. And I took him through the work. It was clear as day he wasn't an alcoholic. He was not a drug addict. He'd just gotten kicked out of med school and wanted back into med school. But you know what? Every assignment I gave the kid, he finished it. And I'll be damned, I wasn't going to walk away from him just because he was a type 1.5 or a type 2. I took him through the work, and his life got better, and he's still sober as of 6 months ago when I talked to him. So this doesn't mean just because you end up being a 2 and 2.5, I'm completely going to walk away from you. And nothing Brandon and I say this weekend is absolute in any way. We'll use words like typically or usually because we know it's not. It's just not. We're just short of giving you our observations. I want to wrap this up so we can get to a good stopping point. Forward to the first edition. That first paragraph, you might as well put a box around it. It's really important. What we recover from, to show other people. I like showing instead of telling. I know sometimes you guys think I'm telling you, but I'm really trying to show you what I've done in my own experience, and then hopefully it'll be desirable and attractive, and you'll want to do it. And our way of living has its advantages for all. So when we get clean and sober, those closest to us, it's an advantage to them because we're not burning their lives to the ground anymore. It's an advantage to us because we're clean and sober, and we get a chance at having a life. But it's really important that I emphasize to you, this is not your way to quit using drugs or to quit drinking. It's a way to create a life that's conducive to long-term and permanent recovery and sobriety.
Permanent?
I think so.
Oh.
They really mean permanent, too. So.
Weird.
And then if you turn the page, I always like pointing out to people this little paragraph. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics and addicts. Who do they really want to hear from? Not someone that's going to a bunch of meetings and maybe had a spiritual experience and just is hanging out. They want to hear from someone that's working with others so they can compare notes and see what's most effective is the way I look at it. I always point that out. I think it's very important. And before we get into this second forward, I do tell the story of Bob and Bill. I'm not telling it tonight because we don't have enough time for it. So I tend to be a little bit of an AA historian. I've read up on it a lot. I have a lot of documented stuff that I send to people that are interested. But the thing I really love to stress is that I made a comment earlier. I told you, you work in the steps is not the real work. It's right out of this forward. After they tell the story of what happened when Bill and Bob meet, and an important thing is, you know, Bill was the first person that ever showed up to talk about the problem to Bob, where Bob understood finally what his problem was. That's why it's so important, Matt, that you discuss the problem right off the rip so you guys can identify and know that you come from the same place. But at the bottom of page XVI, this is a conversation, this is a paragraph you want to highlight or a sentence. So once Bill and Bob started working together, this seemed to prove that one alcoholic can affect another as no non-alcoholic could. One addict can affect another as no non-addict can. It also indicates that strenuous work, strenuous is very hard, time-consuming, sacrifices, strenuous work, one addict with another, one alcoholic with another, is vital for permanent recovery, not one day at a time. So when I work with guys, I'm going to show them how to live life a day at a time. But I'm going to convince them and I'm going to promise them if they apply these 12 steps into their lives and attempt to live the way of life described in this book, that they will have permanent recovery. And it also says that the strenuous work is the 12th step, not working the steps yourself. The real work in Alcoholics Anonymous is cocaine Anonymous is taking others through the steps. And if I'm wanting to move somebody through the steps very quickly, that's the only that I'll read the little story about Bill and Bob, and then I'll spend some time talking about the sentence I just read, and that's it. And I don't do much with the third edition and the fourth edition forwards anymore because Bill Wilson he'd passed away by then. I really like the first two forwards. That's just me.
Yeah, and you know, recovered. You know, there's a lot of debate of whether or not we're recovered or we're recovering. There's not a lot of debate amongst people that do the work the way that we do the work. Recovering is referenced one time in the family afterward where dad is
is recovering. He's getting well. Okay. Everywhere else in the book, I think it's 17 times in the fourth edition, it says recovered. And it's also interesting that the forward to the first edition, interesting to me because I like interesting, stupid facts. The forward to the first edition written in 1939 and the forward to the second edition written in 1955 were both when Bill Wilson was alive. Both the forward to the first edition and the forward to the second edition reference the word recovered. Bill Wilson passed away in 1971. Mm-hmm. Forward to the third edition. The third edition came out in 1975? The forward to the third edition does not say recovered. Forward to the fourth edition does not say recovered. So something happened from the time that the founders of our program, you know, when they released this book and when they released the second edition, we were recovered at that point. Once they passed away, I think it's just because Bill wasn't there to argue it, is that we no longer are recovered. And there's a lot of places in the book, there's a lot of places in meeting, there's a lot of places in the stories in the back where the message seems to be straying from the message that's in this book. And we can spend a lot more time on it, but you know, the steps that we see on the wall, most people refer to those as the steps. That's the abbreviated form of the steps. In the back of the book on page 562, there is the short form of the traditions. It's the same thing you see on the wall. Starting on page 563 for the next three or four pages is the long form of the traditions as Bill originally wrote them. If you compare and contrast the long form versus the short form of the traditions, vast amounts more knowledge, vast amounts more information. The steps are the same way. What we see on the wall and what's summarized on pages 59 and 60 of the big book, those are the short form. The long form starts in the doctor's opinion and goes all the way to page 164. We don't have time to break that down, but to me it's important that I understand that those are the steps. When the other fellowships borrowed AA's 12 steps, they borrowed the short form. There's, what, three fellowships that actually use the big book, which has the steps in the long form. And so it's just, that's just how I like to look at it. I can show you where that all breaks down if you guys have interest, but I think
we're done.
We're going to take a
break. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we'll start back up.
I just had one. Yes. Yeah, I was like, yeah, the one I was like, knocking me out.
That's pretty good.
It's actually pretty wild. Bella actually started all the time. Yeah, she was.